I think we might as well get started. I'm using, in this particular facility, and since we're talking today about politics, I'm using something that is very dear to the heart of a politician, and that is always have a room for a meeting that's a little bit too small. Because you always look like you're having an overflow crowd. And the one thing you want to create, you know, as a politician, is the idea about momentum. And I say that, and it's probably, you know, if you were here yesterday, it's no secret that I learned some of this, because for a while I was active in the Rice, if you're from Minnesota, you know, I was active in the Rice County DFL, and once we wanted to have a big enough meeting center, and we made the mistake of being, you know, totally swallowed up in a room that was too large. So I'm glad they're sitting, and teachers always dream about having students sitting at their feet. Nobody's quite at my feet yet, but if I stay here long enough, maybe we'll get a few more. Anyway, again, for those who weren't here yesterday, I'm Erling Torsten from St. Olaf, and I'm especially interested in my research and my writing is in the field of the relationship between politics and religion. I've done a couple of other things because of certain family considerations with the charismatic movement. I'd like to talk about that next week. But this week I'm talking about various, what I call newsworthy Americans who are involved in one way or another directly with this, or somewhat indirectly, with a thing we call religion and politics in America. And my commercial for tomorrow will be one which is in very much in the news because he went to jail last Thursday, and that would be the Reverend Moon. And I want to take up Reverend Moon both from the standpoint, well, there are a lot of ways with Moon, from the standpoint of the whole matter of cults in this country, from the whole question, if you want to talk about, you know, brainwashing and deprogramming, that raises lots of questions in this country. The whole question about religious liberty in this country. And also, I was able to attend two conferences by Moonies in the last 11 months. Dan Erlander, some of you know, was very worried about me last year. Last year, I was here in June, and in July last year, I told him I was off to a Mooney conference at Madeira Island off the coast of Portugal. And Dan wanted to be sure and found out through some other friends that I had come back without being brainwashed. I had been fattened, to be sure, but by the Moonies, but I hadn't been brainwashed. But I've been happy to talk about Reverend Moon. That'll be on Thursday. And not from the standpoint of talking about their theology, which I think is, well, a lot of hokum, but some other questions that it raises with the question about religious liberty in this country. Is it right to send a clergyman to jail? And, you know, there are lots of questions that are raised there. And I don't know if I don't think I saw any of the rest of you, but in early June, it was at the Holiday Inn Central, downtown Minneapolis. There, were, I like to do field research, and I found out about this indirectly. Louder? Oh, I wish I had a, can you get, does Rich have a PA? Okay, I'll try. Okay. But anyway, I went to a rally in downtown Minneapolis, and it was a strange combination. Would you believe it was ACLU, it was Moonies, it was Catholics, it was Mormons, some blacks, all who saw what was happening to Reverend Moon as a direct threat to religious liberty. And other people say, well, he should have been in jail a lot sooner than he was for various kinds of financial maneuvering. So that's the commercial, what we call the tease for tomorrow. There's always the business about, you know, come back tomorrow, but on Thursday. And then on Friday we'll be on Billy Graham, and on Saturday on Robert Shuler. Because Shuler too got in trouble with the Infernal Revenue Service, as you'll remember. So, today on Ronald Reagan, and this will be not, obviously, a partisan appeal. Apparently you, those who were here on the 4th of July, had a wonderful convention with Ronald Reagan and Gary Hart Lake, and Walter Mundane, and for inclusive language, Jesse Jack Child, right? Because son is much too gender specific, child is I've never heard of Jesse Jack daughter though, so we shall see. Okay, I want to set down, and I haven't, you know, I like to look and have what my speech teacher told me was significant eye contact. I don't know if any of you remember Ralph Hogan, and I had him, and he, the first thing, about the only thing I remember from Ralph's class, it was my fault, not Ralph's, was that we should have significant eye contact, but I haven't committed this one to memory yet, so if I'm looking at my notes, it's only because I haven't memorized just the way I would like to, and some of it is new and fresh, and I welcome comments, disagreements especially, and I'll try to make this such that we'll have time for discussion. It's not going to be a case for Reagan. It's not going to be a case against Reagan. It's not going to be a case Kenny win in November. Historians are modest enough to let the situation work its way out. All of these, I think, are interesting pursuits, and in one way or another, we're talking about these. So if we're not going to have a case for or against him, or will he win in November, then what's left? I think first we have to remember as to what we're going to do today is why we are doing what we are this week. We're talking about important American leaders today who in one way or another are touching on or affecting the interests of all of us, our faith and how it affects us and as individuals and as citizens. And the larger question which is raised, and I'd be happy to talk about this today and Thursday with Reverend Moon and Friday with Billy Graham, because he had a very negative experience, you remember, after Watergate. He has not been in to give you a commercial for Friday, he has not been in the White House since Watergate with Carter or with Reagan. And although he's very obviously sympathetic towards both of those people, but Graham has learned his lesson about politics and Shuler obviously is a somewhat different story, but still, they raise the question, what do we really expect from our governments? Should the government be the agency for the solution of some of our problems? I think that's really the basic question we're getting at here. And to what extent should we rely on the government to solve some of the problems that we aren't being able to solve very well for ourselves? My specific question today, okay, with Reagan obviously, and the one which we're all asking is that, why does he have the appeal that he does? That's where I want to start. Why does he have the appeal that he does? What is there about Americans that lead us to support him to the extent that we do? He won with 51% in 1980. It was not a landslide. That's one little aside I'd like to make you hear about his landslide in 1980. 49% of the American public did not vote for him in 1980, so that's hardly a landslide. LBJ had a landslide in 1964 against Goldwater, 60.2. But he did win in 1980. And what we want to ask then is that why has that popularity grown? I think it depends on which poll you take. It's either 10 or 15%. And it's too early to tell after the Democratic convention last week how much that has changed. There are some instant polls, but I'm very cautious about instant polls. With Reagan, since he has this wide variety of sources of appeal, since there are, we can prove, more registered Democrats in the country than there are Republicans, does that mean then that today we are really beyond partisan politics? We are beyond party. We are beyond our ideology, so we're at the point where we have learned to trust a personality. Is that really what's at work here? For many people, the answer would be yes to this, and that's what we want to look at today, because I think it tells us something not only about our president, but it tells us, I think, something about ourselves. And that's what I really want to pick up in some detail today. The first point, and obviously the most obvious point with Ronald Reagan, is that the people who support him do so because they seem to like him far more than they seem to necessarily approve of this or that or any other long list of specifics of things that he has done or hasn't done. The most instancing, if I were to have sort of a, what's the word I want, free association, if I asked for the first word about Reagan, I'm sure many people would say, I like him, if we put that on the board, sort of instant kind of reaction to that. Reporters noted, for instance, that once when Reagan was talking in a factory, in Missouri, which was very highly organized, and you would think, we hear about special interest for Mondale and all the rest, but in a factory where it was very strongly organized in union terms, all the workers in the factory joined in cheering him and enjoyed shaking hands with him and meeting him, and there was a genuine kind of affection that worked both ways. He is an and I want to go press that a little further. He is an arch-conservative, no question about that. But you see, by contrast, he has not produced the kind of hostility that another arch-conservative produced, namely Barry Goldwater. You remember some of you how hostile those feelings were in 1964? I had good friends that didn't even talk for one or two years afterwards because of that sort of thing. That's not happening today, and that tells us something very important. We're talking with Agnes Larson, my old mentor from the college, and when she found out I signed the professors for Johnson in the Northfield News, the egg hit the fan then, I'll tell you, and we had a falling out for a while. All right. Now, so what's at stake here when you have an arch-conservative who can be so congenial as contrasted to 20 years ago when there were all the really serious feelings of animosity that developed? Conventional wisdom tells us that when a president goes for a re-election, he runs, as is happening obviously right now, he runs on his record. But presidents also strike a personal chord, not just the chord of the record. And they embody, or I think we've come to believe that they must embody the dreams and the values of the nation. And you see now where I'm going with this one. Why is it that Reagan seems to be embodying the dreams and the values of so many people in the nation? One scholar named Thomas Cronin said this: you cannot be a successful president unless you project a vision about the purpose of America. And Americans probably are more concerned with, you know, what is the American thing than any other country. We're always preoccupied with taking a pulse, our own pulse about where we're going, who we are, and, you know, questions like that. And you cannot be a successful president unless you project a vision about the purpose of America. And today, clearly, the public is being influenced, I think, by these kinds of intangibles. Prove of his record or not, Americans like him. He has created a kind of a magic, really, or a kind of an aura about himself. As a candidate, I think he still benefits and develops it very well. He benefits from the public's yearning for a take-charge leader, for a take-charge leader after the succession of national traumas from Watergate to the Iranian hostages. His political fortunes have been helped, of course, by the expanding economy and by the nasty Democratic primary, which has just ended. Yet his best talent is not just these sort of historical events that have developed, but his best talent is his ability to project himself, I think, as a man of conviction, of genial self-confidence, optimism, and old-fashioned values. It is that that has helped him weather countless political storms, largely unscathed. I'll use it later, but I could inject it here. He's known as the man in the Teflon suit. Nothing sticks to him. I think that's the best metaphor. Ann Burford, James Watt, you know, down the line, you know, the Beirut thing, nothing. Ed Meese, you know, they all go right by. Okay. There is plenty to be critical about him, with him, I should say. This helps, I think, substantiate my article. It's not that there aren't serious indictments that are made, and you don't have to be a Mario Cuomo, you know, to have a long list of what's right and what's wrong with what happened. In public appearances, he has been caught in dozens of factual mistakes and misrepresentations. Some of you know this one, Ronald Reagan's Reign of Error. It's a pun, obviously, on the French Revolution, Reign of Terror, and if you want to look at it, I'd be glad to circulate this one. Lots of things, as I say, mistakes and misrepresentations. Or more serious than those would be the abortive mission in Beirut. Cost America something like 265 lives. We have sharply escalated our military presence in Central America. Several of his political appointees have come under considerable fire. And some have been, like Ann Burford, have been forced to retire. But as I say, he is the man in the Teflon suit. Nothing sticks to him. Okay, where does that support come from? First of all, millions of voters who do approve of his policies, support comes from the people who do approve of his policies, and from those who like him as a person, but don't necessarily take much stock one way or the other in the issues. And that, I think, is to be expected. But he gets support from a very unexpected source, from among people who worry about his record-breaking deficits, who fear his actions could lead to war, and who believe that his economic program has clobbered the poor. Well, you'd think, well, these people with foreign policy deficits and all the rest would be the ones who would vote against him or would be opposed to him. He has been more, but that's the paradox here, and I think the most interesting thing. He has been more successful than any other modern president in establishing space between himself and his policies. I don't think there's anybody else who has done this with the great skill that he has done. He is just simply not identified with all the things that people are critical about in Washington. He is sort of above that sort of thing, and for a reason for this, we'll try to probe, and I'd be very happy to have your input on that. His own interpreter of his staff, Richard Worthland, says that it is a mandate, the giving by the people of a stewardship to the president based on trust, confidence, with a system of beliefs rather than with a system of articulated policies. I think that's a nice way of putting it, that he has convinced the American public that he lives by a series of beliefs. And this is what motivates and guides him in his administration, much more than by a system of articulated policies. And of course, I think it's fair to say without any doubt that he has been the most successful communicator in simple terms of communication of any president since FDR. He simply is able, some of you who will remember FDR knew the fireside chats and all the rest and how well FDR was able to project that sort of thing. Of a man in charge, of a man and leader, you learn to trust him by listening to his voice. The famous 1936 election, when the recession was going badly, and all the rest, and yet his voice over the radio was so reassuring, and people learned to trust that. And now with television, we've been able to add the visual dimension to that, and I think that's helped enormously in his case. Okay, now the question is, that's true so far, but will that be enough to have him reelected in November? What about the foreign policy setbacks? Or the fact that the Senate repudiated his handling, for instance, of the Nicaragua situation? Might not a setback in Central America do him in? Or there is the other question, of course, with a person of his age, he could become seriously ill. That's another one that is always in the back of the mind of some people. But all other things being equal, I go with what the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times here, a man by the name of Stephen Weissman, says, and I think it's worth quoting at some length. Yet it seems evident that given the success of his strategy to date, the political marketing of Mr. Reagan's political qualities may change the nature of the 1984 campaign. Weissman is arguing something I think very significant, that the very nature of electoral politics in this country is changing. And it's changing in a remarkable kind of way. And I go back to his quote, "To a degree unknown in recent elections, the challenger will have to meet the incumbent's personality head on. Will have to meet the incumbent's personality head on, matching his style and countering his overarching message with one of his own." Close quote. That's worth mentioning. Countering his overarching message with one, namely in this case, Mondale of his own. And another quote, "The Reagan approach may also have a more lasting effect." Here is the what may be new about our campaign this year. "He has fashioned a new chemistry of image, message, and personality, a presidential persona that could change the boundaries of the American presidency itself." Well, that's a big order, but I think there is something to it. Just let me give a little bit of historical perspective on this. Remember, after the defeat of Goldwater in 1964, the Republican Party is finished. Remember, wrap it up, send it home, start over again. Let's have a really, truly conservative party over here. Let's have a truly liberal, liberal party on that side. Nelson Rockefeller had been wiped out, you remember, in 64. That took care of the liberal wing of the Republican Party. Goldwater had been defeated in 64. It was over. Look at 1984, and if you wonder if the Republican Party, is finished. It's obviously it's got so much money it doesn't know what to do with, and it's the Republican National Treasury. So I'm going to talk a little bit later about some of the commercials that were on television, you remember, the third week in May, and explain why they had to put these things on. But they are, they're alive and thriving and doing very well. So when we make, statements that some things are drastically changing, we have to have a little bit of historical perspective on that. To come back to my point, people like him. He says and believes what Americans like to hear and what they like to believe about themselves. And for instance, this is a strong, and this is why I think it's so significant here. This is, first of all, a repudiation of Jimmy Carter, who liked to quote from Reinhold Niebuhr, quote, "The sad duty of politics is to establish justice in a sinful world." Do you hear Ronald Reagan quoting Reinhold Niebuhr? "The sad duty of politics is to establish justice in a sinful world." You don't hear the word sin coming from the Oval Office, and for good reason, and it's totally sincere on Reagan's part. Carter really believed that, the quotation here from Niebuhr. "Americans in the 20th century tend to elect presidents who represent change more than continuity. JFK's youth and vigor were refreshing in contrast to the stodginess of Eisenhower. Carter offered a change, integrity after the aftermath of Watergate. Ford lost because people couldn't forgive his pardon of Nixon. But Carter and Reagan are very different." That's the point I want to make here. Carter and Reagan are very different, and it's happened in a very short period of time, showing the influence, with the mass media here, especially television. "Carter bore the burdens of the office like a cross." I think that's fair to say. He bore the burdens of office like a cross. And Nixon did the same thing, too. Remember, Nixon wrote a book about My Six Crises, always telling the people how tough it was being president. You see where I'm going with Reagan. How difficult it was to be president, how much I agonized. I'm sure he did. No question about this. I'll keep going back and back till we get to Nixon. Nixon really felt this and took it very, very seriously. And here Carter identified himself personally with the administration's traumas, as did LBJ. LBJ, for instance, if he had one serious shortcoming that hasn't shown up very much, it's that he took delight in learning all the gossip about politics in Washington. He would call up middling level officers and said, "What do you have on?" And he had, he had J. Edgar Hoover keep a direct file, a personal file, on all the things of say Martin Luther King, among other things. But he got directly involved in all these sort of things and thrived on this, and directly identified himself as Carter did with all the daily affairs of office. Carter was fond of telling everybody there were no easy, simple answers. He became a sort of a martyr, for instance, with his refusal in 1980 to set out on the campaign trail because of the Iranian hostage crisis. You remember, he held back, he didn't go out campaigning on the stump, as we like to say, because he said he had to stay close to Washington because the hostages were still, you know, in Iran, and identified directly with those sort of things. As Wertheim says here, he clinging to the Rose Garden, Carter succeeded in turning the White House into a kind of prison, directly, you know, identifying with that sort of thing. He was also, speaking about Carter here, he was also determined to regard the mastery of the details of his administration as crucial to his leadership. For instance, during the Middle East crises, at the summit meeting at Camp David, Carter got down on his hands and knees to read the maps of the Sinai. The President of the United States, in other words, was trying to identify that carefully and closely with the workings of what should have been the operations and the activities of the military and the we've called it the counterintelligence people, or the spies. Counterintelligence is a nice word for spies at that time. For instance, he read volumes of Russian history before meeting Brezhnev, discerning a, quote, a crisis in confidence. You remember his famous Sunday night sermon. He had consulted leading intellectuals. Didn't he consult Dr. Price? Didn't Price go to Washington once to talk to some of the people, if I remember, about what was wrong with the government and what was wrong with the country? I think David did go there and was consulted as one of the leaders, among others. Carter gave the famous Sunday night sermon calling on Americans, you remember, to accept limits to national growth, accept limits to natural growth. And you see where I'm going. On every count here, to make a Paul Harvey page two here, on every count, Reagan's presidency is dramatically different. He enjoys the job. He keeps his distance from the crises. He ignores details, both as chief executive and as chief communicator. No matter how grave the situation might be, he keeps an attitude of upbeat and reassurance. Even, for instance, turning the reappearance, you remember, of the bodies of the Marines to the airport, in the United States, into a time of great celebration of what we call American civil religion. On that, some of that difference between Reagan and Carter is due, I think, to the basic personality differences between the two, and some of it is due to the decision by his advisors that the style of the Carter administration was wrong-headed and was doomed to failure. The new advisors have altogether new and different ideas on how to present the president to the public. The greatest triumph, of course, has been in television, and it was no accident that TV was singled out for the best PR blitz the party could offer. There were some very special needs to be met to sell this candidate to the public. This was not an easy kind of job to be done. It isn't somebody who had a long record in Washington, for instance, that you could build on. But there were some things that had to be done. First of all, Reagan was a candidate of a minority party, long since, with all that entails. Secondly, his plans and his platforms were really oftentimes a radical break with the near past, going back to Hoover, for instance, in some cases. Further point, obviously, he was rather old, and the public had been rather disenchanted after LBJ, Nixon, Ford, and Carter with the whole office of the presidency. There had been this lack or this drop of confidence, in national figures. So Reagan's advisors had to set out to use television to sell the candidate and to strengthen the institution of the presidency itself. They couldn't do one really without the other. To reestablish confidence in the office of the presidency again. Stop to think about how you felt about the likes of, here's one name that'll spoil the day for you, Spiro Agnew. How's that one? What kind of confidence do you have? And I have to put in, Norman asked me not to do any kind of interjecting of partisans. I have to put one in here. And John Schramm told me once that if you're and you're in front of the audience, you're in charge and you handle the steering wheel. And people are talking about Geraldine Ferraro being unqualified for the presidency. I give you as exhibit A, Spiro Agnew, as being qualified for the office of the presidency in 1968. You remember that? Okay. Anyway, enough of that. To a greater degree than ever before, President Reagan's day, you see, is planned around opportunities for television coverage. Every effort is made to assure a constant flow of positive visual images and symbols from the White House. You will never see, for instance, on television, President Reagan delivering bad news. It will be Secretary of State Shultz, it will be Secretary of Defense Weinberger. It will never be Reagan giving bad news. For instance, when the news of what happened in Beirut came, Reagan had already planned to leave that weekend for Santa Barbara. He announced it in a brief statement to the press, and as soon as he announced it, he walked into the into the helicopter and flew off. Weinberger was left with the explanation for the rest of the public, with that sort of thing. Or give you another example. In 1982, when the recession was still going on, with unemployment high, and the president had been accused of having a lack of compassion for the unemployed, he never appeared in public or before the television cameras in black tie. Black tie being, you know, an example of affluence and prosperity and, you know, sort of upper class status. And we've seen, you know, black tie since then, but we didn't see any black tie in, you know, in 1982. Instead, he showed up for events concerned with unemployed teenagers, with dock workers, or at others in job retraining. Or when disaster strikes at a community, President Reagan doesn't stop at sending relief. He flies there, as he did to flooded out Louisiana last year. And I can remember some of you too, that's building on something. Remember 1965 in Minnesota, we had the great flood, and LBJ was president, and somehow Vice President Humphrey convinced him to come out and fly over Black Dog power plant, you know, and look things over, as though that was going to have LBJ flying over there was going to do any good for the, you know, the public down there. But nevertheless, it was reassuring that, you know, this president is in charge. Or getting back to Reagan, when an overseas journey is in the works, producers from the television networks accompany the White House staff on the advanced trips. They figure out the best photo angles of the president. My particular favorite was once after President Reagan had been at Korea and stared across a demilitarized zone, and I listened, who was it, Diane Sawyer, interviewed Art Buchwald, because the press releases had been that President Reagan had been eyeballing the communist enemies. And Buchwald was talking about how reassured he was that his president had the courage to eyeball the communists. just think of how what forces of terror this sent through the North Korean communist community to know that the President Reagan was eyeballing them. And he had put on a military jacket and, you know, a hard hat and, you know, all the rest of the things that go with this. Buchwald is great in America because Buchwald teaches us not to be too solemn about our, you know, about our leaders. And he's always very refreshing. And the skill of Reagan is very impressive. It's very impressive. It's certainly, I think it's fair to say that Reagan is a better communicator than any president we've had before. And it's, you know, the old cliche is true. Abraham Lincoln would never have been elected president. He was homely. He was tall. He was awkward. He had a mole near his nose. He spoke in a high voice. You know, Madison Avenue couldn't have done anything with him. Reagan makes the important announcements of good news. The details, as I say, and analyses are left to the secretaries of defense, treasury, etc. But under ground rules that they may not be identified in the news accounts. As a result, the only person who can be shown on a 7 o'clock news coverage of good news is the president himself, offering broad positive concepts. And check this out when you go back, because Reagan, is, according to the Seattle Times of Sunday, is going to take the initiative this week and next week after what we heard last week. Okay. And the timing, this is very important. Okay, remember when Secretary Watts made his guffaw about the Beach Boys a couple of years ago? Watt was called to the White House and was given a large plaster foot that had a bullet hole in it, a brilliant device for making light of the incident. It was learned later that David Jurgen, director of communications, had commissioned the making of the foot weeks before the Beach Boy incident and had held it at such a time, for such a time just like this. Timing. Timing is remarkable. Or when the first military research investigation of the massacre of Beirut came in, Reagan, you remember, defused it by announcing ahead of time, one day ahead of time, his reaction to this. So that when the investigation, you remember, by the retired chiefs of staff about what had gone wrong in Beirut had been announced, Reagan had already given his impression and his reaction to it ahead of time, which took the sting out of you know, the whole thing itself. He is not only a great communicator, he is a great persuader. Wertheim says this, Aristotle, in writing on logic and argument, said one of the speaker's most important tasks is to understand the psychology of his audience. Instead of lecturing his audience on their limits, such as Nixon did or such as Carter did, lecturing the audience on their limits, Reagan offers good news. There is no limitation to what the nation can do. You remember his State of Union speech last January. America is back. America is standing tall. America is proud. He talks about heroes on battlefields. He talks about people in uniform, not only in Grenada, after we took care of those 700 Cuban carpenters, you remember, down there, and people were breathing easier because of that. But he was able to turn it into a great national victory, like, I think, like Teddy Roosevelt riding up San Juan Hill. You remember, and where, what was it that Peter Finley Dunn said about Teddy Roosevelt? That when Roosevelt wrote his own personal autobiography of how he conquered San Juan Hill in the Spanish-American War, and the only trouble was that when he sent it to the typist, the linotype operator ran out of the letter I in the the account. Reagan tells Americans that if they work hard, if they pay taxes, if they seek a better life for their children, they are heroes too, just like combat veterans. His theme is that Americans can do. After all these years of floundering, which had started in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963, America is back on the track again, according to this. This appeal reaches deeply into traditional Democratic circles, as well as in traditional Republican circles. The America Can Do theme is very popular, for instance, in blue-collar ethnic Roman, among blue-collar ethnic Roman Catholics in the Northeast and in the Middle West, and in the fundamentalist groups, really, in the South and the Southwest. Further, as a persuader, he keeps his message simple. Rather than talk facts and figures, he talks about values, about his cherished beliefs, about inspiring themes. And as everyone agrees, he is a true believer in what he talks about. That's the point. If I've got a long thing here about Americans have seen so many television commercials, the 30 and 60 second spots, that they are no longer fooled by the old hidden persuaders. You remember Vance Packard and the hidden persuaders kind of thing? They have seen these things for so long. When did television first came in? 52 was the first year we got a lot of political coverage. Taft versus Eisenhower, remember? My dad didn't want to buy television for a long time, but he was such an arch Republican and loved politics so much that he even drove to Minneapolis and brought home a television set. And we all sat with those great big boxes and watched Taft and Eisenhower sort of thing. And it's grown since then to where Americans have become very sophisticated about it. And one reason that Nixon couldn't win was that Nixon couldn't convince people he wasn't lying. I think that's fair to say. They've had psychologists have analyzed his facial gestures when he's in the process of lying about Watergate. Remember the Watergate wallowers and the time he had 62 volumes, in royal blue and gold. Here is the truth about Watergate, and there wasn't any truth about Watergate in it and all the rest. People began to realize that Nixon was lying. The same thing was true about LBJ on some of the things about how serious the situation was in Vietnam. The body count was more than just a few boys coming home every Thursday, you remember, when they had the body count. People could tell that, and so television has become very relentless in exposing this sort of thing, and as I say, he is a true believer in what he talks about. One Republican senator said this: he operates on a separate plane from the rest of us. We may find him flawed because he doesn't know the details and can't analyze them, but he can have a simple dialogue with the voters. It's a real personality. Jimmy Carter agreed with you and you didn't like it. This guy can disagree and you think he's great. Next, he keeps clear of the details of political issues. He doesn't get down on his hands and knees and look at maps of the Sinai, and he doesn't call up people around Washington wondering what the latest gossip is. He turns, for instance, a debate over the economic impact of a program into a broader issue of personal compassion. Asked at a press conference about his record on civil rights, he speaks less of his policies than how he campaigned as a radio broadcaster to integrate baseball. Asked about unemployment, he tells stories about the pain he felt when his father was fired on Christmas Eve during the Great Depression. Sometimes this works on allies, too, or our foreign allies. In 1982, Europeans were angered over American plans to place new missiles on that continent. Rather than talk about the details, Reagan talked about arms control generally. With utmost sincerity, he spoke of his commitment in principles to armed control. and to his fervent wish that they had nuclear arms that could be taken from the face of the earth. And apparently Europeans believed him. He has achieved positive communication with the mass of the public, usually by intuition. Okay. So that he has this remarkable freedom from the attack of on the frequent times when his record is at variance with his statements. Even the press today sorts of giggles over his guffaws. For instance, he claimed the government is spending more ever today on those in need than before. But he doesn't say that the inflation has eroded the value of most of such government programs. Food stamps buy less food today than they did several years ago. Well, let me be a little bit more specific. He makes two claims, that there have been no outright budget cuts in major programs. And secondly, where cuts have occurred, the poorest families haven't been affected. The record shows, according to Weissman here, in fact, the funds budgeted this year for the Environmental Protection Act, jobs programs, aid to families with dependent children, social services, block grants for the poor, and aid to elementary and secondary schools are less today than in the 1981 fiscal year, even without including the negative effects of inflation. And according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, about 40% of the reduction in benefit payments have fallen on families making less than $10,000 a year. Or he has sought to weaken key enforcement provisions of the Voting Rights Act, but it signed when it went through Congress, then said, this legislation proves our unbending commitment to voting rights. And remember how he took credit for Jesse Jackson's rescue of the pilot in Syria, as another example of what I'm getting at. He simply has a way of what we call co-opting people. You can give other examples of what I'm getting at here. So how do I explain this remarkable record, and especially how to explain, and the puzzle I have is why the press and the media, especially television, haven't been as hard on him as they were on LBJ or on Nixon, or on Carter. I think there's a qualitative difference that can be measured, that can be proved there. The voters recognize that the president is absolutely sincere in his statements. When some mix-up occurs, it is perceived as a mistaken simplification, or as nitpicking on the part of the press, or from a hostile media. Remember, Nixon used to pick on the media. You won't have Richard Nixon to kick around anymore in 1962 when he lost for governorship of California, right, after he had lost to Kennedy in 1960. You don't hear Reagan saying that at all. Reagan is not hostile towards the press, and it shows through, all right. And the public draws a distinction between Reagan and his personal beliefs on the one hand and his government policies on the other. In June, according to Gallup, 55% approved of his performance in office. Yet other polls showed that they gave his specific policies much lower ratings in Lebanon and Salvador and so on. He presents himself as independent of whatever problems may be vexing the nation. He's a genial host, like he used to be on the GE Theater, to the whole country. At the press conferences, for instance, he has a seating chart that helps him call reporters by their first names. You didn't know that. But it looks so neat when he can call on Ted or on Leslie. Of course, everybody knows Leslie Stahl anyway, so you wouldn't need a seating chart for her. But it's very carefully arranged. There's a woman, there's a black, there's a liberal, there's a conservative. And it doesn't matter who's standing up or yelling ahead of time. It's been orchestrated. But he doesn't do what Nixon did. Remember, Nixon wanted to be sure that royal blue was behind him. For the color television cameras, because that gave some sort of aura. You never see green or brown for some reason. Somebody would have to explain the psychology of color to me on that one, but you get the idea. Okay. As the nation's host, you see, a television press conference becomes sort of like his hosting of the GE Theater. He can fully exercise his profound skills as a communicator and persuader. His charming manner and oratorical gifts are seen to their best advantage. And he tells stories very well. The downing of the Korean airliner, the invasion of Grenada, the truck bombing in Beirut. He tells these stories masterfully. And that keeps him from the full brunt, I think, of public disdain. He can keep on blaming the people in Washington for the problems, even though he's been in charge since January of 1981. Less government is better. But he's in charge of locking the door. And all of this comes very easily to him. He has not changed nor forced a new image the way other presidents have tried on the American public. He is the same away from the camera that he is on camera. He carries through very well, even though there are some contradictions or anomalies. He embodies an old-time America of tightly knit families, small-town neighborhoods, and God-fearing values. Yet he came of age in show business and became the first American president to become divorced. He has an often troubled relationship with his children. He rarely goes to church. Since Inauguration Day, he's been in a church 9 times. And then there is his tithing, which is less than 1% of his gross adjusted income. But those are some of the more severe contradictions and anomalies. Otherwise, he is pretty much as he seems. He is an optimist. His aides estimate that he spends 80% of his time selling his program, 20% of his time shaping them. That has its charms, but it has led many to wonder about the budget deficits, for one, or some of the other decisions he made about sending the Marines to Beirut and so on. But no matter, it is clear, this is the point, he enjoys the job. He never complains about the loneliness or the difficulty. No crises there. He puts in an 8-hour day, he does homework in the evening, and does master materials for meetings and trips. But vacations are vacations. When he went once on his way to Santa Barbara, when in the course of a few days the Lebanese government collapsed, his decision to retreat out of Beirut had caused an uproar, and drop-off died, all in a space of a few days. But the vacation went ahead. America was back and strong, and we weren't going to panic and stay captive to the Oval Office the way Carter did. Okay. His advisors don't want to have him seen as a super crisis manager. If he had come back and held a bunch of meetings, one of his White House aides explained, the public might have developed unrealistic expectations about what could be accomplished. I think that's a good point. He disdains details the way Carter relished them. Carter is still flabbergasted at the briefing he gave Reagan on the Iranian hostage crisis just before the inaugural. Mr. Reagan took no notes at the briefing. That was there. In 1982, he talked to the people of Bolivia when he was in Brazil. Once in front of reporters, he called, you know, this is trivia, but it makes the point. He called his own dog by the wrong name. You know, there's lots more here, folks. Okay. Furthermore, he doesn't seek out experts outside of his own circle of advisors. He doesn't read books. You remember Mondale said when in front of the NEA, here is one president that's going to read books. He doesn't engage in intellectual argument the way Nixon used to bring in intellectuals, remember, and go around with them. Editors from Commentary Magazine and New Republic and people like that. Nor does he seek out information from unofficial sources. He relies, in other words, more on what he hears and observes than what he reads. He's not one to reach out for ideas. But is that so bad? And this is Weissman's point and sort of the summation of what I want to be, you know, getting at here, because the time is running out. His supporters say he is a genius at boiling abstract ideas down into concrete conceptions that the public will understand. He goes for facts that he can understand, down-to-earth illustrations, what will help him communicate and persuade, and he does persuade. And again, that seems to be what the American public wants. Long before television in 1925, Walter Lippmann noted how short or limited the attention span of the general public was on public issues. Lippmann wrote, quote, the public will arrive in the middle of the third act and will leave before the last curtain, having stayed just long enough perhaps to decide who the hero was and who was the villain of this piece. No modern president has explored that tendency more effectively than Mr. Reagan. Now, what might this mean for the upcoming convention? I'm a historian, not a futurologist, but let me say a few things here. The Democrats will have to win on the basis of building a case against him strictly on the issues. He will seem as the nation's host, the spokesman, the friend. He is doing lots of ceremonial presidential things now, and as he's done for the last few months. China, he's going to go at the New Orleans World Fair, the Olympics next week, or is it this week? Time just sort of floats away here. Is it Tuesday or Thursday today? Tuesday, okay. He's gone off. Remember, he's off to the summit in London, to Ireland. He did in Ireland what JFK did. You remember? This is great television coverage, presidential pageantry. But where does it leave the Democrats? Should they question his work habits and misstatements? The voters might continue to think that these habits and slips are unimportant. And can Mondale convince the public he is more sincere, more of a true believer in American values? Already, you remember Mondale's acceptance speech centered on families. Richard Reeves did a fine piece on Mondale trying to shift the debate over to the issue of families. So should they try? In other words, to come back to the final point here, he has simply redefined the office of the president, the institution of the presidency, and the executive branch. And we have about 20 minutes, and I'd be glad to entertain comments, disagreements, challenges, outrage, whatever else goes along with this. Yeah.
Just one.
Sure.
From your perspective as a historian.
Yeah.
Is Reagan, without losing the campaign, without slipping up, and I'm just assuming from hearing you and what I know that his advisors are going to work real hard to keep that slip up from coming.
Yep.
Is he unbeatable? I question whether he is.
The historian in me says no, the Democrat in me says yes. Two things can happen, I think two, maybe three. Interest rates keep going up. Lots of young people, yumpies we talked about yesterday, want to buy homes. The starts, I can't remember, do we have the June starts in? I don't know what the June starts are in housing. But they haven't been going along as well as, you know, some of the others. Interest rates could go up. What are they, prime rate now, what is it, 13%? I think it's 13%. That's one thing that could hurt a lot in November. But then, of course, then you could, you know, but you can't say that he can manipulate the Federal Reserve, because he can't. Paul Volcker is very much an independent, and it has to be said on Reagan's behalf, he had the chance to dump Volcker. And Volcker is very much, you know, an LBJ great secretary, financier. And he reappointed, much to the disgust of Jesse Helms and some of the other people on the right, he reappointed Volcker to the Fed, and so he can't control the supply of money long enough to keep the economy prospering until November 4th. That's one place where there could be trouble. The second is the thing I mentioned before. He's 75 years old. He could get seriously ill. And remind people, you know, that he, if reelected, he'll be the oldest person ever to serve in the White House. Because that would indicate something. You remember how we were told that America 1960 wanted youth and vigor. You remember from JFK, after all the old tired days of Eisenhower, although the historians now are reevaluating Eisenhower's presidency, and it's looking very good. So how can we go to want youth and vigor in 1960 to want stability and tradition and continuity, you see? And times change, that's what I'm saying. I think those two things, if any either of those two happen, I think Reagan would be in trouble, but otherwise I think he's unbeatable. Mondale has gotten as far as he has, as I talked about yesterday, by not making mistakes, except for Manet, and that one was covered over quickly. And now the question will become, now that you have, what's it, now that you've avoided trouble, can you create any kind of incentive or enthusiasm for it? Now that you've got everybody at least under the same umbrella, pretty big umbrella, but still the same umbrella, can you create any kind of sense of momentum where they're going? And we haven't seen that yet. Yeah. Of course, it's a long time till November 4th.
I just had a professor who was a doctor in history. She said that if we, in years from now, look at all of our presidents in the United States, the Reagan would be considered the worst president the United States ever had. And it was really interesting to hear that, because he's not evil in the sense like
Nixon. Say it is, sure, absolutely.
I don't understand the mass of minds that hear this little problem he gives us and just pour on. Is it because we don't want to hear a president struggling with issues?
Would we have the Republican chair from King County here to help me on that one from Seattle? I'd be very happy on that. Seriously, he's going to run, and this is his answer to everything, on the economic record. What was the prime rate? Was 20%, wasn't it, in 1980, if I'm not mistaken, 20%, the prime rate. That's one solid documentable thing that's right there. Inflation is, what is it now, 7.1%? No, unemployment is 7.1.
4.5 for inflation was 12.
Yeah, and it's 4.5 for inflation and it was 12. And people are saying, what about women? He's going to say women are better off economically, and therefore that takes care of the charges about not appointing enough women, and there is Sandra Day O'Connor and others, but that's where it's going to go, and that's what's appealing to, you know, all kinds of people.
But isn't there a fallacy in that unemployment thing? Because after they get off of unemployment, they might have to go on welfare.
On welfare.
On rolls.
I think we're going to get into an argument, folks. Yeah.
All the things you've been saying is, why don't we vote for 100 or maybe more of his advisors? I know he's a good presenter.
Yep.
He has all these people telling him, this is the thing to say, and this is the way to say it.
Then, Weissman of the Times is saying may be accurate, that the office of the presidency is so huge and complicated and involved now that you need somebody who can delegate authority and doesn't get so involved in all these things that, like Carter, he gets, you know, hung up on some of the details along the way. And that maybe the president from this time on is going to have to be simply like in the Anglican Church, the Archbishop of Canterbury. And I don't use that term, that comparison, in a flippant sense. Who can speak for but doesn't, you know, take care of all the work along the way. And that's the kind of person we want. Because this is, you know, who was it? Megatrends, Nesbitt. This is the age of information. We're in an informational age more than an industrial age. And what is it, 56% of the American public wage earners are in one way or another involved in information dispensing jobs rather than in, say, production, like in a factory or something else like that. And maybe Reagan is the first to take advantage of that with these kinds of advisors. Any president needs those. Ted Sorensen helped Kennedy, for instance, for a long time and is one of the great great people. And who was it, Carter's Secretary of State? It'll come to me.
But you get the idea that if he doesn't really have an idea of his own, he has to rely on...
He's taken the people from California that he learned to trust in 8 very tough years in California with him. Remember Edwin Meese, the way he went after the business in California, University of California, Berkeley, and all the rest? And he trusts these people, and he's willing to stand by them. I would submit that even if they showed that Edmund Meese is something less than, you know, clean on all of these things, he would stand by Meese right to the bitter end. And he doesn't rely on anybody except these, you know, these people. And when they goof up, then, like Watt did, he stood by them for a long time. I remember, and then finally he had to let go. But even then, he has a Saturday morning radio speech. Even then, he said that Secretary, after he had been deposed, that Watt was one of the greatest Secretaries of Interior. You know, loyalty is very significant there. And loyalty is what he puts, the emphasis on, yeah.
One of the things we're forgetting about is the dynamics of what makes a country go. Expectations have a lot to do with that. And leadership has a lot to do with generating expectations. If you expect to fail, if you expect to work hard and not get a whole lot, by golly, that's what will happen. But if somebody's able to convince you that that you will be successful and you can grow and you don't have to bear that cross all the time, you're liable to believe that. And that's one of the reasons that we've turned around. People are expecting it to get better. People are expecting to have jobs. People are expecting business to be good. That's what the stock market's all about. Stock market is totally expectations.
Yeah, but it's down to 1,100.
I'm not saying good, bad,
okay,
whether it's
I see what you're saying. Okay.
I'm just saying that's what drives the stock market at this point, or at any point in time, is what expectations are.
Yeah.
And so you can say what you want about various aspects of the Reagan administration, but he, in the context of leadership, in terms of giving you something for the country to go for, he's done a good job with that. I mean, whether you like his specific policies or not, he has given the American public some of the things they want to hear and things that they respond to.
It's the genius in the way they diagnosed the flaws in Nixon and in Ford and in Carter, and turn these around. I think that's, you know, in terms of the PR, that's where they've done, you know, whether you agree with the results, as you're saying, whether you agree with the results or not, that's where the success, I think, has come in. They knew exactly what the American people didn't like before, and were able to move in a different direction.
I think if Mondale's going to make anything happen, people have to think of him as a leader.
Yeah.
And not, I don't think they do.
Not as a facilitator.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
So it can be said that President Reagan has exploited the economic situation solidly. Because if you look at all the other things that he has done on the political field, you don't find any support from the American people.
Yeah, he's lowered inflation at the price of keeping unemployment up. You really, in a sense, have to choose between the two. You can't have lower unemployment and lower inflation really at the same time. And he's chosen to lower, you know, inflation. Yeah, yeah.
It's the pulse of Mondale, and is continually bowing to some pressure group, unions, to name a few, or name one, but there's all kinds of things that each time something comes up, he seems to bow to it. What effect is that going to have on the American public? If he gets into some crises or something, he's going to bow to some of these things.
The Democrats would say that Reagan has bowed to all the people who produce armaments. In this country, we've got the huge, you know, the continual more and more spending for armaments, and that's just as much a pressure group or a special interest group, in Washington as the others. That would be a partisan answer to what you're saying here. But what Mondale is trying to do is, try the old FDR formula one more time. I'm trying to get some others in here. Yeah.
You started out all the time.
No, you're the one.
You started out with the thesis of showing the connection between the indirect or direct use of religion and politics.
Yeah, I didn't get to that. The old clock on the wall. Remember Jack Benny says we're running a little late, folks. And that's nostalgia time for some of you, but the rest of you don't know what I'm talking about. But anyway, I didn't want to get too specifically into this, but he has come across with, who was it, calls about religion in general. Oh yeah, Marty. I should mention Marty. I mean, anytime you talk about religion in America, you talk about Martin Marty. And Marty calls this kind of religion in America a cosmic slenderella. In fact, it's putting on, you know, my mother used to call these foundation garments that take away all the wrinkles and the bulges and all the unattractive features, and you come out with what everybody sees as attractive and, you know, and well, just that kind of attractive. And if you pin it down rather specifically, it's hard to say, you know, where he is. He was, his father was a more or less indifferent Catholic. His mother was brought up in the Christian church, or sometimes it's the Disciples of Christ, if that's more specific for you. Reagan didn't show any specific interest, as Eisenhower didn't, you know, in any denomination for a long period of time, and didn't join a church in, he went to Bel Air Church, in Presbyterian Church in Los Angeles when he lived there, but didn't join any specific church, still hasn't joined any specific church. But what he's been able to do is to convince people, you know, that his rather simple, direct, uncomplicated, you know, commitment is in harmony with what most American people want. And he's gotten himself, obviously, he's had to, I'm going to talk next week about the moral majority, he's had to respond to the pressures of the new Christian right, because they've demanded, you know, a stance on school prayer. They've demanded a stance on equal access, on moment of silence, on things that call for a direct kind of connection there. And since the 82 congressional election, he's come out much more in working with and trying to work with the evangelicals and the fundamentalists. So I'm going to talk next week about this thing called the American Coalition for Traditional Values. You know that one? Ken Woodward wrote a piece in Newsweek for it 2 weeks ago on that, and he's endorsed the idea of religious people getting directly involved in registering voters. And I've got that in print, for instance, if people want the documentation for that sort of thing. And in a sense, he's alienated some people because of this. You remember his evil empire speech and one sort of thing. And he said also that he isn't quite sure that creationism isn't a better interpretation, you know, of the origins of the earth than the evolutionary interpretation. But again, it's the man in the Teflon suit. These things just sort of float right by. I've got a good piece I'd be glad to share with you. My good friend Dick Perard has talked about how Reagan has been able to win over the evangelicals. Even though, as I said, his record by what evangelicals expect is rather poor. And hence, it's one more example of this. He did delay that, you know, getting into school prayer, the major scenes in public and all that for quite a period of time, but now he's had to take a stand on it. But already, I think he did that when he knew his constituency had already been cast. I mean, the die had been cast for his constituency, and he could take those moves without losing really very many people. Yeah. You in the green shirt. Who's waiting? Right. Okay.
Would it be fair to say that Reagan is the personification of American civil religion?
There's two kinds of civil religion. You know, Marty's, again, Marty, some of you know, my students here will know, resonate to when I mention Marty. And if you ever have the chance, Marty has three wonderful tapes here. Mm-hmm. Listen to Marty's tapes. He is, you know, he is, the world is a better place because of Marty. I'll be glad to go on record in saying that, really. Just an extraordinary fellow. But Marty makes a difference between two kinds of the one who used religion to glorify the state. Nazi Germany would be the best example, or a very good example of that, with all the religious symbols and the flags and the pageantries and the rituals and all that sort of thing. Or the Old Testament prophetic realism of where, you know, woe unto you Israel, where the prophets open up their heavy artillery and what's wrong and repent, turn back, forsake thy foolish ways, kind of, you know, approach. And it is, I'm working on this right now, and hopefully in a couple of years I'll have it ready. I don't want to rush into things, but it looks like Reagan is using civil religion really in a sense to justify things like the invasion of Grenada. I mean, that's my personal interpretation now. And I saw, I'm still impressed, and I'm getting the video on this. Did some of you see the Memorial Day service from Arlington Cemetery? Just for fun, anybody see that one? Okay. It was American civil religion at its highest point. At the key moment, he was standing behind the flag over the casket, as ready to, you know, sprinkle, you know, dust to dust on it. I think that sort of thing. We had the Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox, and Jewish chaplains there. They sang hymns from all four traditions. There was something for everybody in the American civil religion thing, and you went away from there, you know, feeling good. And then it turns out, and I don't mean to, you know, in any way diminish the sacrifices that were made in the, you know, by the men in Vietnam. It turns out that they were about 90% sure they knew who the, you know, the person was. But the decision to have the ceremony at Arlington had been made. And my own feeling about that is that's fine, that's terrific. It was, in fact, I'd love to get a thing here on Vietnam in a week or so. You know, my only problem was that why shouldn't we have honored the Vietnamese veterans, you know, 2-3 years ago? Why wait until an election year to honor the, you know, the Vietnam vets? That would be my thing there. So I think that's, I have to explain, that's a sort of, in Minnesota people would understand this, that's a Hubert Humphrey kind of answer to your question. Humphrey could never give a 2-minute or 2 or 3 word answer. But Humphrey, I'll just leave with a good story here. Humphrey would always give a long one. Sometimes, say it was a 10:15 and there was a 10:30, you know, deadline on Meet the Press or Face the Nation, somebody like Larry Spivak or George Will or somebody would ask a really tough, embarrassing question. And Humphrey would start off as only Hubert could do. 5 minutes later, Spivak would say, "Will you come to the point, Mr. Vice President?" He said, "I'm coming to that." 5 minutes later, Hubert was still going strong. Hadn't answered the question at all. Finally, at the very end, "I'm sorry, folks, our time has run out." And Humphrey sat there with a big cat who ate the canary smile on his face. And that's what I've done here in answering your question. Okay.